So Peter Wolfe, we met in prison, but not under ordinary circumstances. If you recall, we met in Bullingdon Prison and we were delivering a restorative justice course to some inmates. And you struck me as one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met. So just tell everybody your background. How did life start for you?
Before I go there, can I just say this about that time at Bullingdon Prison? One of men who was on that course is in touch with me today. After all this time, it changed his life. That particular course, his words, not mine, changed his life. He's never reoffended since. And so I just thought you'd like to know that.
I'd love to know would I remember him, do you think?
Pelly, do you remember Pelly?
Yes.
Pelly.
Was he the guy sweeping the corridors?
Oh, I can't remember that much detail, but he was from Slough. That's all I can remember. And he was a drug dealer. And we talk quite regular. And everything's going right for him.
Oh, that's the best news, Peter. Thank you for telling me. So let's hear about you and your life. How did it begin?
My life, how did it begin? Strange life. I was brought up by my grandparents, who I thought were my parents. And for most of my life, I called them my mum and dad. And they... he was a bank robber, and she used to buy the stolen property, and everyone used to come round our house, all the chaps and all that, you know. And so my brothers were gangsters, really and truly. You know, people who I looked up to were people like John McVicar and things like that. You know, John taught me how to box and all that sort of stuff, you know. So it was... he bought me my first pair of boxing gloves, John. These were my role models. These were the people who I really looked up to. And anyway, cut a long story short, they died, and I weren't overly disappointed, if I'm really honest, because the mother figure, who my grandmother, was quite violent. She tried to beat me to death with a iron poker once, and I truly believe had not someone come in and dragged her off, I wouldn't be here today recalling that story, but I'll never forget it. And I was in prison when she died. I had 6 weeks left to serve, and as they do in prison, the door opened and the prison officer said, "Got some bad news, your mum's dead." and that was it. And I thought, oh dear, you know, that's handy. I can get out, go to the funeral, and pick some drugs up, you know, if I'm honest. You know, that's the truth of the matter. And I didn't really shed a tear at the time. And anyway, they both died. I'm in prison. I'm in my 30s by this stage, and I get taken out. I have to go on an ID parade for an identity parade and for a jewel robbery. And so they take me from, I was in the Verne, I think, or somewhere, I think I was in the Verne in Portland, and they take me back to London, and I go on this ID parade, and I don't get picked out, and they're taking me back. And I'm cuffed up to two police officers in the back of this car, and two policemen, you know, the police officer driving and the police officer. And the one in the front passenger seat turns round and puts a big brown manila envelope on my lap. and says to me, "You've been really hard work. You trying to try." I said, "Oh yeah." He said, "You've adopted," and I can't let him see that I don't know any of this. I go, "Oh yeah, yeah," but really and truly, I'm thinking, excuse my language, I'm thinking, "What the fucking are you talking about? You've got the wrong fella here." So anyway, I get back to the prison and I'm dying to open this envelope to see where they're getting these ideas from. And I get back to the prison and I run back to the cell and I rip open the envelope and there's all these birth certificates and God knows what in it. And I start looking and I suddenly realize that I wasn't adopted. I'd been brought up by my grandparents and my mother was the person that I believed to be my sister all these years. And so, in effect, it's like having, you know, the options that you have for children, you take them out and mix it up, and they've got to put it back, you know, sheep to sheep, cow to cow. Suddenly, someone took my oxygen out, and I couldn't put it back together again because it all got confusing. And it was probably the biggest shock of my life, biggest shock of my life. It was like, wow, because, you know, there's suddenly Alice, who's, you know, she's dead now, who was my mother, before that, she was my sister. And not only that, she was the person I used to use with, I used to take drugs with her, we used to do all sorts of stuff together, go out, you know, you know, she took me, when I was a young kid, she took me to see the Rolling Stones and gave me an LSD tablet and said, "Enjoy these." And I did, you know, I really, really did. And, but all that time, obviously, she knew she was my mother. But anyway, yes, I don't bear no malice. I don't bear no malice.
How old was she, Peter? Sorry.
They done what they thought.
There's a horrible delay on the phone, so we just have to work our way through it. But how old was she when she had you?
She conceived me and delivered me at 15. I was a twin, and the twin, I'm told, I don't know if this is true even, I'm just telling you what I've been told, is died of diphtheria when we was like young kids, when we was little. I got no child, this twin, no, not even a spiritual thing, you know, nothing. I got absolutely nothing. Lived with them, and like I said, she tried to beat me to death with this iron poker, and I got a scar just here, what my granddad done, what my dad, yeah, the granddad, we call him granddad because it makes it easier. Well, he punched me in the mouth and my teeth came through my lips. I was about six when that happened. And I could trace it. I could tell you exactly when it was because Doctor Who had just been invented. And William Hartnell was Doctor Who. And it was really, we only had a black and white telly, but you had to put a tanner in the back to get it going and all things like that. And I stole some money off the mantelpiece so I could go and buy a Dalek, a plastic Dalek. When I got home, my granddad said, "You nicked some money off the," and I said, "No." Nah. And he punched me straight in the mouth and my teeth come through my lip and he beat me up, you know, he properly punched me head in sort of thing. Anyway, a little while later, I come home from school, and in the hallway of the house where we lived was all these boxes with my stuff in it. I could see bits and pieces of my stuff. And so I was seven because my mate Roy had just been born, and I always remember Fred, my granddad, who was my dad, looked at me, and I looked at all these boxes, and there's, you know, and I'm a baby, you know, I'm a baby. And he said to me, "We don't want you no more. You're going to live with Alice." And it just seemed perfectly normal that someone wouldn't want me, sort of thing, because why would anyone want me? You know, bosh, off I went somewhere else. And off I went to live with Alice in the Crescent up Essex Road, and in a great big Georgian house, and it was just me, her, and little Roy in it. And this great big, she married a gangster, and he went to prison, and had this great big ass, and she liked going out clubbing because she was still young, you know, she was still young, and so my job then was to look after Roy, you know, to change his nappies and put the pins in the cherry tail nappies, and put, we had a thing called a baby Burko boiler, and I had to put all these dirty old stinky old nappies in this boiler. Oh, it used to stink. And I just told about it, I could still smell it, like ammonia. And then I had to get these things, like tongs. And I get a mat, these nappies, and it was really hard. You know, when you're 7 and 8, it's really hard to do these things. Yeah? And we had this mangle, you know, a coat ring, a clothes ringer. But you didn't press buttons, you had to turn a handle. And I had to get this nappy on the handle, and it was really hard. I'll never forget it. It was just something I'll never forget. And so I brought Roy up for probably the 3 years of his life, and I didn't do a very good job because he's doing life imprisonment now. So that was my early years. You know, early years, I went to a prude school at the age of 10. I remember I got arrested. I started taking, cut a long story short, I was already drinking alcohol. God knows, really young, I started drinking alcohol. And used to get jubblies, things called jubblies, those like pyramid-shaped blocks of ice. And we used to get Yearly. We used to find a man shop called Yearly's. God, talk about memories just come back. And Mr. Yearly used to cut the top off for us, and we'd go outside and ping me a bit of ice straight out. We didn't want the ice what was in it. We just wanted the holder. So and then we'd go into this other shop and nick some sort of cider, I can't remember, and some sort of wine, and mix it together in this jubbly container and drink it and get drunk. You know, it was what we done. It was just what we done. And people, it drew attention to us, which we all liked attention, and because we didn't really get a lot at home, I suppose. I liked the feeling. I liked being out of my head. I liked it because it didn't put me where I was. Sort of thing. It took me away from where I was. And then I started smoking cigarettes, and I was 8 years of age when I started smoking cigarettes. And the first packet of cigarettes I ever bought was a packet of Cadets, and 10 Cadets, and they cost me $2. So I used to have to go around the shop every morning anyway with a note to say, give Peter X, Y, and Z, and I'd come back with it, sort of thing. And part of that was cigarettes. So Mr. Yearly didn't think nothing about giving me cigarettes. He didn't know that was me, sort of thing. And then I started crying. I just went into crying, and I found out at an early age that money was the governor, you know. That money was quite influential, and it was all about power. And everyone who I knew, or everyone looked up to, and everyone, you know, who I wanted to be like, all had money. So obviously, I wanted that bit of power. And it started with all the way back with the Dalek, you know, because having this little plastic Dalek, it was like having an iPhone, whatever, 12 or something now, you know, it was like, wow, big deal. So I started doing crime and started getting arrested at the age of 10. That was the legal age you could be arrested. I've been in and out of police stations, God knows how many times before I was 10. I was, you know, excuse the French, I was a fucker. I was a fucker as a kid because I was a street raker. I didn't like anything else but the street. And then I got arrested and I was on bail for burglary. And the magistrate at Bow Road Juvenile Court told me that I had to go to school because I weren't going to school. And he gave me an exercise book. And this exercise book, I had to get the teacher to sign it. And you know, back in the days, you didn't have any of these whiteboards and this board. It was a chalkboard. All your lessons were written up with chalk, and there's one teacher, job lot. After I got my book and I went to school, and I'll always remember the kid I was next to, Eddie Hobbs. I'll never forget Eddie Hobbs. After 3 or 4 days, I said, I've had enough of this, Ed. I said, and you know what a compass is? You know what a compass, what you draw a circle with? Well, on a chalkboard, a compass, I don't know if you can remember, the point on it is about 3 inches long, and it was made of wood, and you undone them, and it was like having a rifle with a bayonet on, sort of thing. And I said to Eddie, I didn't even know, Penn, I didn't even know the name of this thing at that stage. All I knew it was that thing, yeah? And I said to Eddie, I've seen that thing now. I'm going to get it, and I'm going to stab him right out the bottle with this. I've had enough of this, and I'm going. And Eddie said, you wouldn't dare. But I was 10. Of course I'd dare. I'm striving to be the centre of attention at everything I do. And I get this thing, and for some reason, all the girls the class. And they was all giggling, and I felt so important. You know, I got all the girls, all the attentions on me, and my little chest was puffed out, giving it Mr. Big, and I go, wallop, and I give it to this guy who's writing out half times, half quarter, and he goes, wow! And you know, in life, Penny, you know, in life, you know immediately when you've made a bad decision, yeah? And this was one of those times I thought, what have I done? I've made a mistake. But he was angry. Rightly so, yeah? And he tells me, and he's screaming at me, and all sorts of explicits are coming out, and it was the old swing doors through the old building of the school. And he's older. I'm young and he can't catch me, sort of thing, you know, and I'm running and laughing and I get to this swing door and I stop and I kick the door and I hit him straight in the face with it and it knocked him unconscious. Unfortunately, it broke his jaw. Unfortunately, I get arrested for grievous bodily harm on the teacher and I go back to this court and the magistrate tells me that I was an unruly child and, at the age of 10, I was locked up for 3 years in grade school. And it was a nightmare because this place was renowned for violence, you know, by the staff onto the kids. It was renowned for corporal punishment. And unfortunately as well, it was sexual abuse and brutality. So for 3 years, well, it got shut down after 6 months of me being there. And we got dispersed all over the country. And then they come and got us and took us back. And they changed the name of the place. And they painted it. And they met us at the gate. And we were standing there at in the grounds, and come Bentnose, who's the headmaster. I don't want to give names because it's their families. I've got to think of their families now. They're probably all dead, but I couldn't thought of their families being heartbroken. So Bentnose come out and said, "Oh, don't worry, boys, we've made mistakes, bloody, bloody." And as he's talking, the staff are getting behind him. And this guy, he says to me, this kid I'm standing next to, he went, "Look," he said, "it's still all the same staff here." So it was all the same, just a different name. You know, it was just the same. So at three, I was raped, I was beaten, I was, you know, atrocities, real atrocities. It's hard, you know, it's hard. One minute.
You okay?
So I come out, I come out of there and I was 13 and I never went back to school because I didn't know school had me. And I just, again, I was on the street. My family had nightclubs and all that sort of malarkey and sex shops. So I was just given loads of drugs, amphetamines, blues, criminals, and told to stand outside the experience and sell these, 10 a pound. And that's what I've done. That was basically what I've done from the age of 13. When I'm 14, this guy come up to me and asked me to do a trade with him for, I didn't know what I was doing the trade for. He said, "I'll give you a 5 pound bag of China White for 20 of them tablets." Well, 20 of them tablets was 2 quid, and 5 pound for 2 quid seemed like a good deal, no matter what way you looked at it. And he gave me this bag, and he said, "You know what it is?" I said, "No." He said, it was different. It was, everything was different back then. He said, "It's emery." I said, "Emery?" He said, "Yeah, heroin." I went, "Ooh." So I don't know about that. I said, "That's what all the scumbags take, ain't it?" He went, "Nah." He said, "It's lovely." And he took me to a club, and there was this guy in his 40s, and I'm 14. And he injected me with heroin, first time I ever took it. And there started the love affair with heroin for me. It's kept secret in England, really and truly, my own addiction. No one knew about it for years because I was getting hold of a few quid, and, you know, I presented well, and, you know, because I was quite respected in the criminal world, it was, no one said anything, no one said nothing, I could do what I wanted, sort of thing. And then that started my career as, you know, I was once described by a judge at the Old Bailey as a professional criminal, and that may have been so, debatable, but his words. And some time later, the best way to describe me would have been a professional prisoner, because I had done nothing but go to prison and become this person who's always in jail. Get out of jail, go back to jail. So in prison, let me tell you about prison. First time I went to Wormwood Scrubs, I was 15, and the Borstal Wing, and I had it quite sweet there because a few of the gangsters over on D Wing was told to look after me with whatever I needed. They had, what's the best way of putting this? They had corrupt prison officers, which still goes on, and straightened out, and they just bring me over all my tobacco and everything I need. And by the time I got in and out of Borstal, double quick time, and but I got my first 3-year sentence when I was just before I was 17, and I read my first book when I was 17. I never read a book in my life. The only thing I read was the racing pages, and I didn't even really read the football stuff because I'd go to the football and wanted to see, so I didn't need to read about it, sort of thing. And it was all, most of my, you know, because I liked gambling as well and taking drugs and drink, all things which, you know. So, and at night, at the end, just before we used to get locked up for the evening, people used to be running around, look, got a book to swap, you want to swap book? And I always just say, no, I don't do that, I don't read books. And because I didn't see the sense of it, I couldn't see any sense of reading a book. It didn't mean anything. It just, there was nothing there for me. And this guy opposite me, and it's funny how you can remember. I can remember his name. Yeah, his name was Clive, and he was from Coventry. Funny, you know, I just remember it. He came over to me. He went, "Why don't you read books then? Can't you read?" Can read. I said, "I'm not a fool. I just can't see the sense in reading books." He said, "Here, read this." He said, "Just read it." And the book, and it was called A Stone for Danny Fisher by Harold Robbins. Oh, flipping out. I couldn't put it down. I just couldn't put it down. I realised so much pleasure could come from a piece of paper, because that's all it represented to me, was a piece of paper. And I read that book and I was amazed. I was just amazed. I was gobsmacked by the whole thing. However, at the education part in the prison, I was madly in lust with the English teacher, and I needed to impress her. So up there I went, made an application to go and see the English teacher, and like it was something magnificent, I go in. And she said, "Well, what can I do?" Yeah, I said, "I just thought I'd come to let you know that I read a book." She must have thought I was completely insane. She went, "Oh, yeah?" I said, "Yeah." She went, "What book did you read?" And I told her. I said, "Got any books you think I should read then, miss? Because I want to impress her. I just want to impress." And she went to her bookcase and come back and went, "There you go." And she gave me this book, and I took it back to the cell. And it was called One Day in the Life of Ivan Dinosevich, and it, by Solzhenitsyn, and it blew me away. And I went on this mad journey of Russian literature. I just devoured Russian literature. I had to read every single book by Solzhenitsyn, then I had to read every single thing by Dostoevsky. It just, you know, I had to, because they was the greatest things ever to appear in my life. You know, now I think back to reading Castlewood and bloody hell, you know, what a book, what a book. And so anyway, that's where my love of, I think, learning, I started to learn. I realised that reading was learning, memory was learning. And then suddenly I realised what had been going on for me, that I used to feel quite inadequate because I didn't have these worldly things to talk about. So I became the best at all this, you know. I could quote you, you know, Dostoevsky, I could quote you Kafka, I could quote you anything, you know, anything you wanted to know about, I was your man, yeah. And because I needed to be the best, you know, I needed to be the best at something. Everything I ever done, I was the best table tennis player in Moscow, I was the best football player in Moscow, I was the best fighter. Yeah, had I not got onto drugs and everything, I probably would have been the best crook, sort of thing, and all these sort of things. And when it comes to reading, I wanted to read the best books. I didn't want to read soppy books, you know, and I want to read literature. It had to be literature. And so that I had a love affair with literature for a lot of years. Even now, but I'm lazy now, books now, but it's got to be literature. I can't listen to anything else or or self-help books. I like self-help books. So that was me journey, I suppose. Bit by bit, the drug addiction, because you know what happened, and why I decided to be the best drug addict. I wanted to be the greatest drug addict anyone had ever seen. I wanted to be able to, because I used to put the stuff in the, you know, I don't know if you understand it, but I always injected stuff, and so the heroin, I used to put copious amounts of heroin into the spoon to cook it up, and people used to say to me, what are you doing? That'll kill you. And I go, no. And as I was injecting it, I could feel myself going, and my catchphrase, for want of a better word, used to be, close to death. You've got to be close to death. Because that's how it had to be. It was always an all or nothing for me. I had to be all or nothing in everything I've done. And, you know, injecting cocaine, the heart felt like it was going to explode. So next time I've done it, I injected even more cocaine. And I can remember being up my aunt's house and injecting cocaine. She's sitting there crying, thinking, oh, what have you done, you know, because I can't breathe because I've injected so much cocaine. But that was all part of it, being the best. And then I got into recovery, half a style, and I found out, unfortunately, about relapse, you know, in the early days when I first found out. But now I want to be the best relapser. It goes on and on and on and on and on. And anyway, I stopped all that, and all I want to be is the best person I can be.
How many years?
That's all I want to be nowadays. But even that,
how many years
clean?
How many years did you spend in prison, Peter?
18 and a half. And strangely enough, I'm now 18 years and 3 months clean. So I'm catching up. The clean time now is catching up with the incarcerated time. So,
you've had
and all that sort of.
You go.
Okay, so I clean up in prison and I make a decision, that's it, no more, I'm going to do this. But at first, it weren't really because I wanted to be a nice guy. I just wanted to stop drinking and stop taking drugs so that I could be a better criminal. That's the real reason I stopped taking, you know, substances. But and as time went by, I was thriving. I was doing really well, obviously, because I give it everything I've got. You know, I don't just do a little bit of it. I'm in there. But all of a sudden, mortal enemy, the prison officers, are coming and patting me on the back, telling me, wow, Peter, we're so pleased. We always knew underneath there was something special. And there it's, yeah. And here I am. And now I'm something special and different again. And I'm thinking, yeah, I like it. And as time went by, I started to realise it was okay to be okay. And I went and done, off I went to another prison and done the RAPT course. Greatest thing I ever done in my life was the RAPT probe. You know, I done restorative justice, a doorway, that opened the door. But for me, the RAPT program, introduction into the 12-step program, was saved my life. You know, it just, restorative justice saved my life because it made me more aware. But, the actual legwork, the actual nuts and bolts, the actual hard work, I've done what I've done, I'd say, without that, get involved in the 12-step program, you know, different class, in the class. So I graduate from the RAPT and I'm sitting in my prison cell one day reading the Guardian newspaper, which I only ordered because I like telling people I like doing the crossword, which was true, but I didn't have to tell people this, you know. It was another bit of me, you know, it was the ego. And as I'm reading one day, I'm reading it from Wednesday or Thursday, whenever the classifieds is company director 100, and I'm thinking, I was still insane. Yeah, I could do that. Those sort of things. And all of a sudden, there was this little box. And this little box, this little box said, "Would you like a diploma in interpersonal skills?" And I said, out loud, as if I was having a conversation with this little box, "Yes, please." Because I was crazy. I was completely nuts. And I sent away for this thing and never really thought about anything other than yes, please. You know, yes, I will. And all of a sudden I get all this stuff come through the post of prison about this course with the University of Wales. And an invoice. And I didn't have two aprons to rub together by this stage. I didn't have two bob. So I took it all to the office and took the invoice and I said, "You're going to have to help me send this all back." And I wrote a little letter and I said, "Sorry, but, you know, thanks, but no thanks. I'm in prison, blah, blah, blah. We get a fiver a week. I can't pay for this." Send it all back. Little guy goes past and I get a letter and it said, "Why don't you write to the bursar? You may be in line for a bursary." Well, you might as well have said, "Why don't you check the carburetors on the Starship Enterprise?" Because I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what any of that meant. And so I writ this letter, very childlike, you know. It was like, "Dear Mr. Bursar," yeah. And I told him a story, basically what I'm telling you now. And lo and behold, I got a bursary. And it was only for a diploma, and I found it too easy. I just found it too easy. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way, but what, you know, all the stuff I'd read, you know, not just, you know, I mean, I'd read some real, like, you know, Carl Gustav Jung, I was always reading him. You know, I was crazy about the guy. You know, he was one of my all-time heroes sort of thing. And so I said, "Can we speed this up a bit? Because it's supposed to be a two-year course." I said, "I need to speed this up a bit because this is no good to me. I'm not getting, you know, stimulated here. I can bash one of these assignments out every night." So in the end, they compromised with me and let me do it in 9 months. So that was that done. Got that one out of the way. And then I decided I wanted to be a drug and alcohol counsellor. And because it just seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, I know what I'm doing. I'm an addiction counsellor. And I went to this prison and opened them and I asked, "Can I go to college?" And the governor said, "Sort it out and I'll give you a rattle, release on temporary license." And so I sorted it all out, went to the interview and got accepted. And I started doing this addiction counselling, higher national diploma. And the day that I qualified, the day that I get the certificate and everything, I thought to myself, because the nuts and bolts I'd already read, doing the practical, because you have to do the practical and all that sort of stuff, and so many sessions to get your hours and all that. It didn't light any fireworks around our bonfire, so to speak. So I thought, "I don't really want to do this. It's not for me. What should I do?" And I thought, "I'm out of prison now. I'll get out of prison. Just out of prison." And my head is still messed up. You've got to realise this. I'm still quite a messed up one. And I'm thinking in my head, I'm in my 40s, thinking, what can I do when I grow up? Yeah? What can I do when I grow up? Because I felt like a little kid. And I thought, "Oh, no, I'll be a criminologist. It's got to be easy enough." to be a criminal, so criminology's got to be a breeze, surely. So I get a bit of funding together from various sources, and off I go to become a criminologist. And I do that, and I don't really tell anyone about it. I just keep it to myself, because I don't, you know, I don't really need to tell anyone. It's just, you know, I don't know. It's just something I don't really, it don't matter to me no more. It don't matter. So what? So what? It's like I was going to do a PhD. Nah, so what's the point? You know, what's the point? All I want to do is learn to play golf and be a bloody good golfer. That's what I really want to be, is a really good golfer. And I will do it. And I'll get a green card and all that sort of stuff, you know. And because I've done my research and I know what's got to happen if I want to play at St Andrews or somewhere like that. So I like to achieve. And this is all it. And everything I do is not really out of ego, and it's not really for gain or anything like that. It's, I just like to do it. And once I start to do something, I can't let it go. I can't let it go. I don't know if I told you, I was in Paris on the 25th of this month last year. I'm in Paris doing, helping Sycamore do the launch for the French Sycamore, yeah? And I can't speak a word of French. On the 24th, I'm here, and it's Esther's birthday on the 24th, and it was blazing June, and we're having a big barbecue, and all our friends, and all of a sudden it gets mentioned that I'm off to Paris the next day. And Henrik, my friend, he went, "Can you speak French?" I said, "I can just about speak English." I said, "Come on." And I said, "How can I speak French?" So I tell him I'm an interpreter, and so I ain't got to worry about doing anything except saying hello. Suddenly, as I say that, all I can think of was René out of Hello, Hello. Do you remember him? Hello, Hello. That's all I can think of. All the way to Paris, I have to get a plane from here to Schiphol, and then from Schiphol to Paris. Yeah, that's the way. All the way, I'm practicing my hello, 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 hello. And I'm thinking, I can't, you mustn't. So I get booking my hotel, and the people come and pick me up from the hotel, and off we go to this prison and we sit down, and the film, what, the Wolf Within film, it's been dubbed now into French, yeah, and so they just look at the film, and it's time for me to introduce myself as this guy who they've just seen. And I say, like a fool, hello, hello. But it goes straight over their head, because they've never seen hello, hello, have they? Anyway, it was great. It was great. It was really, really great. This story's leading somewhere, obviously, yeah? So, after we've done two prisons, we're having, we're in this restaurant, just, I don't know where, and I've still got the interpreter plotted up next to me, because I have to have this interpreter wherever I go. And all of a sudden they tell me, Dominic, who is the person who dubs my voice, yeah, is coming to meet me. And I feel really quite honoured by this, yeah? And Dominic comes into this little guy, like me, you know, he's just like, he's a little fella, and he's bald, and he's, yeah? And he ran there, from wherever he came from, he ran, yeah? And he had this bag, anyway. We're sitting and we're talking, and, you know, through the interpreter. And he says, I bought you a gift. And I say, that's jolly nice of you. He goes under the table, this paper bag. And he goes, there you go. And I look at this paper bag, and it's got lovely French, italic writing on it, all the swell. And I'm in an hotel, and I'm thinking, oh, nice, box of chocolates tonight, Netflix and a box of chocolates, lovely, yeah? And I'm like, look, kid, I say, can I open it now? He goes, you'll be impressed with this. He goes, oui. Yeah, so that's my French. I'll get this, and I look in the bag, and in this bag, there's this beautifully gift wrapped with a lovely ribboned bow box, which I think is a box. And I say, can I open it? He goes, yeah. And I get this thing, and I rip it open, and it was a King James Bible. Well, I don't know whether to be resentful or grateful. Because I'd set myself up for this box of chocolates, and now I've got a Bible. And I think, but you have to be magnanimous, don't you? You have to be the best you can. And I say, thank you very much. And he says to me, are you a Christian? I say, no, I'm not a Christian. I'm just people. And he goes, have you got any beliefs? I said, I've got faith, but I don't have to have beliefs to have faith. Sort of thing. I've got faith that, you know, there's something good. He says, will you read this then? I said, of course I read it. So they say to me, because I'm not thinking, because it's sick, well, obviously, the whole Christianity thing is. So they said to me, don't read the first part, just read the New Testament. So to me, that was like saying, don't read the first 10 chapters of the idiot, just read the last bit of it, yeah? And I said, no, that don't make no sense. So, it's in next door. I read pages. Since last year, I've read 2 pages every day. And it's been a battle. And it's been a battle. But I will, I'm determined to get to the end of this book. And the Old Testament is probably one of the hardest things I've ever come across in all my life. Because they did love a family, the Old Testament, didn't they? You know, Joshua, the brother of Isaiah, who's the cousin of... And then Ruth, who was this and that and this and that and this and that, and you think, oh, my God. So, anyway. My 12-step program suggests to me, right from the word go, that I need to have a God of my understanding, yeah? I need a higher power. No, I had no problem with this, Pam, no problem with this for a long, long time. So for 17 years, I decided I was going to call the God of my understanding, my higher power, I was just going to call him the governor, and I've done with it. And every morning I got up and I went, morning, Governor. If it's all right with you, I'll have a nice day. Yeah? And that was my prayer for the day. Yeah? Evening. Just before I put my head on that pillow, I'll say, thank you, Governor. And that'll be it. Bit of gratitude. Yeah? So it's 17 years I've done. So I start reading this blinking book, and all of a sudden, the Governor becomes God. Yeah? And I still ain't worried at what it's all about, but suddenly it feels a lot more comfortable saying God, good morning God, than it does good morning Governor. Make sense? Does that make sense to you?
Mm.
No. So anyway, that's where I am in my life now. That's where I am.
So listen, you have described the most extraordinary story. You spend most of your life in prison, and then you're just about to match that amount of time out of prison. You've been committed to being the best at anything it can be, whether it's destructive or positive, but you have to be the best. What do you do with your life now?
My life now is... really and truly, it's not about me anymore. I don't I just need to help people. I just need to enable people to realise the best in themselves. I think we've all got it in us to be the best we can possibly be, but some people get lost. And, some people scare, some people just don't know, some people, and some people just need a hug. And if I can be that person who gives that the hug or puts an arm around a shoulder or points someone in the right direction, that's what I like to do more than anything, is to help people. I'm trying to, once this COVID-19 malarkey thing is, I don't think it's ever going to go away. I think our whole world has changed forever, personally speaking. But I'm hoping to form the reintegration people. It's about helping people, not just from long-term imprisonment, but from long-term addiction, from institutionalisation, whatever it takes, to help them have a smooth transition and, you know, to enable them to realise their dreams. This is what it's really all about. Because, listen, I live my dream. Go on, sorry, Fred.
Well, I was just going to say that what you described, that reintegration project, is... And you know my thing is mental toughness, and it takes a great deal of courage, a great deal of resilience, commitment, focus, determination, all those things that are mental toughness. It takes a great deal of those things to change your life. Where did you get that from? Have you always been mentally tough?
I think I had to be mentally tough from an early age. We have to show resilience, don't you? You know, I went through a lot as a kid, from my grandparents, who was, quite brutal, quite unloving. I had to show resilience. I had to be the best I could on the streets. I went to prison and I had to be the best I could in prison. You know, I got abused in a school that they sent me to, and I couldn't let them win. I couldn't let them win. You know, I couldn't let them win. And I had to be as strong as I possibly could. And as life's gone by, everything I've tried to do, I've done, I've always succeeded in what I've set out to do. I've always, what I do is that I like smart thinking. I'm quite a fan of smart thinking. And so I like to look at the pros and cons of things. And, if I want to do X, I've got to look at all the things I need to do to get to X. If I don't think it's realistic, I won't do it. I just won't do it. I have to be realistic about my life goals now. Because if I'm not realistic, it's like disappointment. Expectation is the pathway to despair. And if I expect to succeed and fail, probably a bit of despair could creep in. Specific, measurable, achievable, realistic. Realistic. It has to be realistic. Do I really want to do it? Is it achievable? Do I really want to do it? As time's gotten by, it's not really, not really. It's not about me anymore. I don't care about what, I've achieved everything I really need to achieve. It's just about, like my friend Danny, for instance, who's just doing so well, I just need to be there for Danny. I need to be there for no reason then. I need to be there for Danny because we're kindred spirits, And I admire Danny. I admire him hugely, And I know you spoke to him recently, and there's things he didn't tell you, which, man, just
I thought Danny was amazing. So listen, just to wrap up, what and thank you for your time and thank you for your openness and honesty, by the way. But what would your advice be to anybody who is needing to make a massive change, a big transformation? What do you say to those people?
Ask for it. It is don't be proud. Ask for help. Be realistic. You know, don't put up barriers because, you know, all your life you've had barriers put up for you. Stop putting the barriers up. Anything's possible. Anything is possible as long as you're realistic about the anything, you know?
Yeah.
We can, support, help, but be realistic about it, all, you know, and be true to yourself. Be too true to yourself. You know, I can't. Positive mental attitude. This is what it really boils down to. PMA is the only way to coin a phrase. You know, it's like, it's, you've got to want it. And you've got to want it bad enough, you know. Do you want to live? Do you want to die? This is what I work with people in addiction. And the choice is theirs. Do you want to live? Do you want to die? Leo, come on. Let's do this and let's do this together because we can do this together. If you know, if you need help, I'm your man, yeah? I'm your man. I'm there for you. If I can't help you, I'll phone Penny up. I bet she would. Yeah? Or whatever, you know. I'm there. Yeah. But do you know what I mean, Pam?
I do.
It's true because we know where to go now. We know who to reach out to. Yeah. Some people don't know who to reach out to. Yeah?
Yeah.
I think the most important thing, the most important gift is the gift of listening. You know?
Yeah.
You need to listen.
Well, I hope there's lots of people listening to you right now. The sound hasn't been great. There's a horrible delay, so I apologise to everyone listening for that. But I really, your story is inspiring. It's a bit shocking. It's surprising. But the most of all, it's the most beautiful story that you've done. What you've done, and I ought to say that your book is called The Damage Done. Is that right?
That's right.
And your film is The Wolf Within.
I've made three films now, Pin, actually.
Oh, have
you? I can't think of the name of them. I'll send you the link to them later on.
Yeah, right.
I'll
put them up. Do
remember what you will say.
Listen, Peter Wolf, you are an extraordinary human being. Thank you so, so much for your time. You are, just pleasure. Think you're amazing. So thank you for your time, and we'll see you soon.